Did I ever tell you what the definition of insanity is? Insanity is doing the exact same fucking thing over and over again, expecting shit to change. That is crazy.
In a common understanding of the French Revolution, there is this idea that the French peasantry rose up, guillotined their king, and immediately abolished the monarchy. The reality of the revolution was that it initially started at the highest levels of French society, and was primarily a movement dominated by highly educated elites who saw and exploited contradictions in the old feudal order of French society. Importantly, though, the original goals weren't to abolish the monarchy. Just diminish it. Several major events occurred that converted the belief that France should move towards constitutional monarchy into the belief that France should have no monarchy at all. But this wasn't immediate nor unanimous. In fact, from the revolution's start in 1789, it took until 1793 for Louis XV to be guillotined at all. Definitely a long time to keep a king around for a nation supposedly rushing headlong into republicanism. If you want to learn the history in all its detail, I can't recommend Mike Duncan's Revolutions podcast more. A link is in the description, and it sheds a lot of important nuance on this important world event. For me, the most important thing about the French Revolution is that the most drastic changes to French society didn't come about until the French people started to believe they could build a society without the king. Remember that for later. I recently watched a video by YouTuber Super EyePatchWolf, also linked below, about influences and content creation. Not only did it affirm my belief that social media influencers and their industry is one centered around scams, it also made me realize that I'm probably not going to make it on YouTube. I never wanted to be a professional YouTuber. For me, making videos and doing streams is an occasional hobby that I do because I enjoy sharing my opinions about things. But personally, deep down, I suppose I still wanted to make it big. I'm pretty sure every YouTuber wants their next video to get a million views. In the back of my mind, there was a voice reminding me that if I ever did make it on YouTube, and that's a big if to begin with, I could move away from my full-time job and just do YouTube full-time. After watching Super EyePatchWolf's video, I realize now that that was just a fantasy. And that's okay. A major takeaway from Super EyePatchWolf's video is that YouTube has driven all content creators to want to commodify each and every aspect of our lives to grow our channels. Making a video for its pure artistic value or just for your own personal enjoyment is ultimately a suboptimal way to do it if you want to actually do YouTube full time. Of course, I think that's wrong. Deep down, I think we all know that if the entirety of YouTube were to be dominated by what would be profitable, then the platform would be an extremely terrible one to be on. So while I will still come to terms with the idea that I won't ever really make it on YouTube, it's fine because I don't need to make it on YouTube to live. What if you do? Enter Shadiversity. Shadiversity is a YouTube channel and brand created by YouTuber Shad Brooks. The channel centers on discussions of historical and fantasy arms and armor, with a particular focus on their use in things like video games and books and TV shows and the like. At the time of writing, Shad released a video titled, YouTube is an unfair platform that hates most creators and it's getting worse. More evidence. This video and the core question it asks, but doesn't really answer, is the subject of my video essay today. In short, I want to do my best to talk about why YouTube is the way that it is, offer counterpoints to Shad's understanding of the problems, and try to give alternative solutions. To make sure I do a fair job of presenting his arguments, I have included links to the original video as well as a supplemental VOD of a livestream that he did regarding the matter. This video is not going to be a direct point-by-point refutation of his arguments. In fact, in principle, I think I agree with Shad regarding the fact that there is a problem with YouTube. I want to be upfront with the fact that I am a very left-wing person, and Chad is a conservative, So we are going to have major political disagreements, to put it lightly. It would be bad form, in my opinion, to simply dismiss Shad's claims offhand because he's a conservative and he's making a video where he's ultimately whining about his treatment on YouTube. For him to be a 1 million sub channel, to be in the position that he is in, whereas we are, what, under 1,000 subscribers? Apples and oranges, really. Personally, I've never really been into the type of content that he makes. That's neither here nor there in terms of the wider point of this video, but the standard disclaimer applies. I'm making this video in good faith, and no one should harass Shad regarding the views expressed herein. If he wants to actually talk about them in more detail, he's more than welcome to email the channel, and we can set up a debate or a discussion. Of course, that's not a call-out or a challenge. I prefer to debate my agreements with people, not bully them. Finally, I will be using some clips from the original video to illustrate his points, but otherwise treat this like a podcast because there really aren't going to be too many visuals for this. This video is also going to be fairly long, so I've provided timestamps for the different sections for easier viewing. Chad's basic claim is this.
Okay, so this video is not something that I'm making as a knee-jerk reaction. This is a result of months of observation and noticing consistent patterns and evidence to lead to some troubling conclusions, unfortunately. And it's pretty much that right now, currently, YouTube is screwing me over, and not only me, more generally the community. I am a part of the community of the Sword. I'm part of multiple communities because I have multiple channels, but also other communities as well. It's probably not news to many of you. YouTube's bias, prioritization, favoritism is something that has been known for quite a while. And I've been outspoken against that for years. This isn't just me coming out and complaining, but also sharing evidence and other things because it's affecting me. I've been outspoken against this type of stuff for a while. Back when Thane...
On the face of it, this is a perfectly reasonable claim to make. Anyone who follows the firearms channels on YouTube, like Forgotten Weapons, have known that such channels have frequently drawn the ire of YouTube and its monetization policies. By virtue of being in a similar interest space, with often a lot of community overlap, the Sword community is also in somewhat of a precarious position in terms of growth, traction, and projected growth. Certainly, no one expects the top YouTuber in the world to be a Sword YouTuber at any rate. There are some reasons for this, possibly that the Sword community is not advertiser-friendly, and therefore not as valuable to YouTube as other communities. We can debate those claims at another point. Of course, Shad is not making the claim that people are losing interest in his content. The claim that he's making is that YouTube is deliberately either hampering or neglecting channels like his in terms of subscriber growth, view counts, and thus ultimately revenue. His argument is as follows.
Where all of us are getting affected. And this is happening in other communities as well. I've been getting, you know, just as I briefly mentioned it in passing on Twitter, or when I get people responding to me, they mention, yeah, this has been happening in this other community and this other creators mention it and stuff. So this suppression isn't just happening to us Sword creators, it's happening to a good number of creators on the platform. The next thing that gives me very strong confidence this isn't just my own content getting less interest is a statistic that you actually get to track on YouTube analytics called click-through rate. So when YouTube recommends a video, it tracks the percentage of the amount of people who actually click on the video after it's recommended. That gives you the percentage, the click-through rate. So obviously, then your natural conclusion should then be a video that has the same click-through rate as another video. Well, then that means people are clicking on it the same amount when it's getting recommended, so the views should be about similar, should they not? Well, turns out, no, not all the case, not recently. That's how it should work. But YouTube is actually actively doing things to make it not work that way, because views can still be far, far lower, even if you have a really good click-through rate on a video, if YouTube just doesn't recommend it. Give notifications, and that's exactly what's been going on. Take a look at these two videos right here as just one example. My Obi-Wan Kenobi fight scene autopsy, and my video on Knights vs. Dinosaurs. The fight scene autopsy has been out a week longer. The dinosaur one has been out 7 days, but I can easily find what the views were at the 7 day mark, and so if we go to 7 days, it's the Obi-Wan Kenobi had 113,000 views. So, Obi-Wan Kenobi, more views. Let's have a look at the click-through rate. The click-through rate on the Obi-Wan Kenobi is 1.9%. All right. Now, by the way, click through rates are different between creators and stuff. My average is around 3%. Okay. It's generally low, but it's been enough to sustain me on my channel for years. It's been that like at that point for a good while. And so even though this Kenobi video got below average views, still better than what most have been doing lately, that's on 1.9, 2% click-through rate. A video that has done fewer views, okay, the dinosaur one, have a look at the click-through rate. Its click-through rate is 4.1%, twice as much. People are clicking on this video twice as often when recommended than the Kenobi one, yet it has less views. YouTube's not recommending. That's the only conclusion you can come to. It's not that people are not interested in the video. In fact, people are interested in this video twice as much as the Kenobi one. Why did YouTube decide to promote the Obi-Wan Kenobi fight scene autopsy versus the dinosaur knight one? It's because it was trending, okay? Star Wars, Obi-Wan Kenobi was just out and I was capitalizing on the trending thing that there was more interest. And when you do that, YouTube is, because more people are consuming Star Wars related content, it naturally promotes that content more than it would normally. That's the key. Because conversely to that, when I make a fight scene autopsy video, based, you know, Star Wars, that's not trending, well, doesn't perform nearly as well. My previous fight scene autopsy video, this is the fight between Kylo Ren and Rey. All right, let's have a look at how many views it got in the first 7 days to get this right comparison. 88,000, far less than both those previous videos, okay? And the click-through rate was pretty low as well for this one, 1.7. So,
the click-through metric is the number of click-throughs over the number of impressions times 100. A click-through is just a viewer selecting to watch a video, but it's the impression part that's actually of more value. Impressions on YouTube are simply the number of times a thumbnail of the video is shown to viewers on the platform. The argument that Chad makes is quite simple. The viewers are the ones who decide if they want to check out a video, but it's YouTube who is the one that decides what videos ultimately get shown. Of course, I don't exactly agree with the framing of this as conclusive proof. So, therefore, the argument that Chad makes is that if you have two videos with different click-through rates, but one has a higher click-through but lower views, and the other one has a lower click-through but higher views, then YouTube is weighing its hands on the scales to decide which of the videos should actually get shown. And that is, of course, something that is not within his control, but their control, and therefore they're being biased towards him. Of course, I don't exactly agree with his framing of this as conclusive proof. A click-through rate is just a metric for a single video, and Chad doesn't really present any kind of higher level analysis of his videos. Looking at a single video, drawing some conclusions from that, that's not exactly good data analysis. I don't think it's necessarily his place to do that type of analysis, but it definitely doesn't seem as conclusive when you think about it for a little bit. YouTube operates as a business, and they make business decisions, same as Chad does with his channel. I believe it's entirely possible for legitimate reasons to underlie changing audience retention or changing audience proliferation, and I will link to a video from Dark Viper AU, who I trust a lot more in terms of his understanding of the YouTube algorithm, for an alternative perspective about Chad's statements. Of course, I do think it is worthwhile to just see what YouTube says in any event, in their help section, regarding click-throughs. They have this to say. The YouTube community guidelines aren't exactly super helpful if you're wondering why your videos aren't being promoted as often. They're not strictly speaking exactly consistent either. Despite their clear statement about not allowing scams, YouTube is definitely full of crypto YouTubers and influencers who are most definitely participating in or enabling scams by preying on their audience. So I think the question is, why is all of this important? Aren't we just talking about one person whinging about their success or lack thereof on YouTube?
Work so damn hard to make not only the best content that me personally, I feel I've made across my entire career on YouTube, but also supporting others. I have 5 full-time employees. Yes, I'm included as one of those full-time employees in my business. But I have people who I'm supporting a livelihood to, responsibilities that I want to meet. And so when you come across and run into unfair treatment, okay, they're suppressing your success separate to the effort and work you're doing, it is incredibly discouraging.
It's important because for people like Shad, YouTube is their livelihood. For someone like me, it doesn't necessarily matter whether or not my YouTube career picks up, but for plenty of people, it's a matter of life and death. I don't necessarily want to accept the claims of Shad at face value. It's entirely possible that the decline of his channel is entirely due to factors that have nothing to do with YouTube. Certainly, no one can sustain channel growth indefinitely. That's one of the major flaws of any type of enterprise in this type of marketplace. Skullagrim, another sort of YouTuber, one that I like more, also made a response video to Shad's, in that he presents a little bit of a more nuanced take regarding his frustrations with the platform and its issues. In part, watching those videos inspired me to make this one. Regardless of the opinions of a single YouTuber, there are plenty of problems with the platform, from their monetization problems, how they handle copyright claims and the abuse of the copyright system, and what content they allow to proliferate, even if that content harms others. It's an injustice that reflects a deeper problem in the way the digital ecosystem is built. I care about this because YouTube is a bedrock of the internet. It dominates the media landscape in ways few others do. If it enables the exploitation of people who actually make it successful, then we have to deal with that exploitation. I want to see a better world created, but one of my problems with Shad's video, and hence why this video essay is what it is that he's not really talking about the real problems of YouTube, and thus I don't really think any of his solutions will actually work, or at least work for people other than him. A lot has been written about why YouTube behaves the way it does. I disagree with Shad when he brings up a possible left-leaning bias with regards to YouTube and their treatment of conservatives. Conservatives overwhelmingly get banned on YouTube and other similar platforms because they keep breaking terms of service. That's a very simple explanation, and far more likely than there being some large institutional bias against conservatives. After all, conservatives overwhelmingly make up the large institutions in many places. Neither do I particularly believe that YouTube is a left-leaning company either. If being a conservative on YouTube is hard, I would invite anyone to try and be a queer YouTuber, especially one who is trans. Skullagrim said it best in his video when he said that YouTube is not a person. It's not a conscious entity. It's a company owned by Google, one of the largest corporations on the planet. YouTube doesn't really do anything for personal reasons because it's not a person. Even if the CEO says something, it doesn't necessarily mean that that would 100% be translated or even directly implemented. As they say, YouTube is far more than just the sum of its CEO's press releases. Even the CEOs are definitely reduced to but a singular cog in that vast overriding machine. A better explanation for YouTube's behavior is purely one of incentives. YouTube is a company that exists to generate revenue, and that's what it does. This is a key distinction from necessarily strictly being profitable. YouTube doesn't have to be profitable for its parent, Google, but that's not to say it doesn't generate value in other ways. Being one of the largest video platforms on the internet, YouTube enables a huge amount of data and traffic to proliferate in an ecosystem that it has almost exclusive control over. A Google-commissioned Nielsen study found that younger people watch more YouTube than all linear TV networks combined. This also means that the argument that YouTube undermines its own profits by deprioritizing channels like Shad's in favor of others is also kind of wrong. YouTube doesn't really care about individual channels. They care about their overall reach. It doesn't matter if they can get more users by promoting sword content to the sword community. What matters is the totality of the ecosystem that they have developed. The sword community is a niche within a niche. It's not a surprise that his video about the best lightsaber does better than the more esoteric topic of, ironically, sword fighting in space. If they can maximize their numbers by leveraging fewer and fewer channels, they'll do it. No channel type or content type is above being used in this way. That's why we tend to see trends that rise and fall. No doubt, part of the reason the sword content is given a low priority is that advertisers, people with the biggest commercial interest in the value of YouTube, don't want to be associated with brand risks, however real or imagined. But if anything, that's a problem with the fact that YouTube wants to cater to advertisers. It has very little to do with the fact or the inherent value of the sword community as a whole. While I do have a technical background and real experience with designing recommender systems, I don't really think discussions about YouTube that fixate on the algorithm are all that helpful for a number of reasons. Firstly, if YouTube ever actually clarified how their recommendation system worked in any real detail, then their platform would be immediately exploited by people trying to capitalize on that new information. As it stands, people still try to do this now, and the system is still thoroughly opaque. For all the talk about how even YouTube don't understand their algorithm, it's just talk. YouTube is not a rogue AI being run in secret by some mad computer. It's a company of people, run by people, who are its shareholders. The choices that YouTube makes regarding what they do and don't reveal are all social choices, not technical ones. When the company chooses to do X or Y in the algorithm, it chooses to do so because it maximizes their goals as a company. Treating it as almost some pseudo-divine process, actually, I think. That's the real people who cause all this harm slide under the radar sometimes. At the end of the day, we have to acknowledge that some amount of recommendation system is going to have to be used. YouTube is a massive platform with billions of hours of content. It's a Pacific Ocean of content, and humans alone can't swim through it by themselves. We have to treat YouTube's problems like social problems, because that's what they actually are. There is no magic algorithm that could be capable of solving all the problems that people have with YouTube and the way that it recommends content, because those problems are deeply rooted inside the institution itself. That's not to say that there's nothing that could be done about the algorithm choice and so on, just that overfixation on it is useless if we want to actually make YouTube better. Something that invariably comes up in discussions about YouTube is that largely, YouTube manages to reign supreme as a video platform. Unlike TikTok, which only has short-form content, YouTube stands as a titan in terms of a wide variety of different types of long and short-form videos. And of course, since most people would tell you that monopolies are bad, it stands to reason then that it's reasonable to assume that part of the reason why YouTube is bad is because it has a de facto monopoly. However, I don't necessarily agree with this argument. Firstly, not all monopolies are inherently bad. There are things called natural monopolies, which exist in industries and sectors where the barriers to entry are very high. As a result, only one enterprise tends to exist for this industry. This is not necessarily a bad thing. The most obvious example are public utilities. Imagine if instead of a single electricity provider providing power on a single standardized grid, you had hundreds of different energy companies all competing on their own grids to provide power. The cost of setting up power plants of any real value is already so massive that it just makes sense to regulate the single industry where normal market forces don't work at all. Nudge-nudge healthcare industry, for example. YouTube, I would argue, represents an underlying type of natural monopoly, namely the provision of public media services on a massive scale. When people talk about competition to YouTube, they're talking about places like Rumble and Odyssey, services which are tiny in comparison. Rumble has at most 150 million users. That sounds like a lot, but YouTube has 2.4 billion. Rumble has just 7% of the audience that YouTube does. It's a drop in the bucket. Really, the idea of building a digital infrastructure that could compete with one established by YouTube is laughable. Because, number one, there are going to be massive expenses that most companies just will not be able to bear. But number two, competing with YouTube actually means competing with Google, and there really aren't also competitors to Google either. No other company can provide the capital expenditure to rival what YouTube has built out, or provide the infrastructure for the scale of operations that YouTube carries out, a point that I will discuss later. But suffice to say, even Chad agrees with me that there aren't competitors to YouTube. Even as bad as YouTube is, it's still actually possible to make a living as a YouTuber on the platform. The size and scale of the platform enables the creation of a massive digital ecosystem that is capable of supporting all manner of content creators. No, we can't solve our problems by imagining an alternative to YouTube, because realistically, none could exist. But there are other reasons why competition doesn't solve this problem. Imagine for a moment we're watching a foot race. You might agree with me that the most exciting part of the race is when a bunch of runners are all fiercely fighting to be first. The outcome is uncertain, they're all jostling for position. I definitely believe that. There's drama, there's stakes. But does the race carry on forever? No, it has to end. Competition is like that. Sure, you might imagine that if YouTube had rival companies that challenged its existence in ways that companies like TikTok don't, for example, then it might have to work a little bit harder to retain its viewers. You know, it might have to offer them more as consumers and also give more to attract content creators. Only, this is not going to happen forever. It's not even going to happen in the long term. The hypothetical ideal state of competition is extremely fragile. YouTube has Google's backing. What stops them from buying out any major competitors, consolidating many companies into one, forming the same monopoly? Could you really say you'd give up millions of dollars to gamble on a chance to dethrone the king if you were a rival CEO? There's also collusion. Companies don't have to compete. In the US, the major network providers divided the country into different fiefdoms, where they get their say. Who's to say that wouldn't happen with competitors in the global market share? Maybe YouTube remains the most popular app in countries that are in the global north, but in other countries, it's another one. There's also collusion. Companies don't have to compete, you know. In the US, for example, major network providers have divided the country into different fiefdoms, where each of them gets their own sway. No competition there, is there? Who's to say that wouldn't happen with competitors and a global market share? Maybe YouTube remains the most popular in some countries, but in other countries, it's the same type of company. Because this type of industry is one that is prone to being a natural monopoly because of the high costs involved in setting it up, this exacerbates the difficulty of actually building an alternative to the company. Finally, what stops a competitor from doing the same things that YouTube does? Realistically, how many times has one king deposed another and turned out to be the same kind of tyrant but with a different flag? YouTube is a company operating under market incentives in one of the largest markets in the world. Any company that replaces them will more than likely be subject to those same market forces and those same incentives. What stops the same fundamental problems from just repeating themselves? Should we then wait for someone else to come along, depose the deposer, and hope for the best? I don't think so. I don't think that competition can save us here either. By the way, as a reminder, I have loads of problems with Chad's suggestions of using Rumble and Odyssey. If you want to hear my thoughts on that, check out the patron-only bonus episode. So then, I've put forward what I hope are a number of compelling arguments about why some of the proposed solutions to YouTube won't work. It's easy, of course, to stand on the sidelines and criticize, so I thought I would also try to bring up some solutions that I think we actually should be considering. These are not perfect solutions. I don't believe that these will magically solve all of our problems, but I do think that they move us towards a better solution that meaningfully addresses some, if not all, of the problems that keep reappearing with YouTube. The most basic building block of any professional YouTuber is the monetization of their channel. Once you meet certain eligibility requirements, you're able to join the YouTube Partner Program. Once you join the program, you are then entitled to receive a share of revenue from the ads that YouTube runs on your videos. There are some other options, including channel memberships, but let's just focus on the revenue sharing. One of the main problems with YouTube is that exact monetization scheme. YouTubers get paid based on ad revenue on their videos. That means that if a video doesn't do well, or reach a large audience, fewer ads are going to be served on that video, and thus less income will be generated by that video. Because of the problems that were previously mentioned regarding the algorithm and what it chooses to show people, this means that a YouTuber's income can potentially be extremely volatile and definitely inconsistent. It's okay if YouTube money is just a cherry on top of your other incomes. It's potentially ruinous if you depend on YouTube to pay a rent. I don't imagine blaming the YouTube algorithm will convince your landlord to give you a break when you're short. So if we're looking to change YouTube for the better, it might be worth changing the employer-employee relationship between YouTube and its content creators. Only, YouTubers aren't employees of YouTube. I know I've been talking about YouTubers as if they have a traditional worker relationship to YouTube, like say, the writers at Vox, or the developers at EA, but they don't. YouTubers are not actually employees of the YouTube company. They're much more like independent contractors, and this makes their relationship to YouTube quite complicated. Let me paint a picture for you. YouTube isn't a company that opened up a video store and hired people to make videos for it to sell. Instead, YouTube set up a huge, big fairground and invited people to set up their own tents inside. YouTube provides very basic services, video hosting, for example, and a very relatively lax entry policy. Pretty much anyone can start a YouTube channel. It's free. But that's also the catch. YouTube isn't hiring people to make videos for its platform. It is an open platform that, by virtue of having such low barriers to entry, will attract loads of people to produce stuff on it on their own free will and time. YouTube's nominal business model, its real customers, aren't the video watchers. It's people who want to get the video watchers, namely the advertisers. People who want a captive audience so that they can sell ads to. The very people who make YouTube the attractive platform that it is for the advertisers are also completely unconnected to the platform that they use. YouTubers aren't traditional employees, and they aren't really contractors either. YouTube doesn't contract specific creators, as a rule, to produce content for their platform, but they appeal generically to everyone who wants to make YouTube videos, be it professionally or otherwise. This disconnection also makes solving the problems that creators have with YouTube much more difficult. YouTubers are not traditional employees. They don't have the same kinds of employee protections under the law, and they definitely don't have access to the same types of internal company communication channels when something goes wrong. If something happens to your channel, you can't really go to an HR department in YouTube. Generally speaking, you're better off served by raising a fuss on Twitter and hoping that someone at YouTube sees it. This is not a great system. YouTube is, of course, notoriously committed to paying as few real people as possible to actually provide support, be it to video creators or to users. Fixing that problem, I think, could be best served by government regulation, but that's a topic for later. Right now, I want to focus on two suggestions that are reasonably practical in the here and now: a YouTube Creator Fund and the YouTube Union. I have a lot of problems with TikTok. Some of them, I assume, are because I'm an old man and new things frighten me. But other things are probably due to how quickly someone can be radicalized on TikTok. Again, another topic for another day. But TikTok does have something interesting that YouTube doesn't: the TikTok Creator Fund. The Creator Fund is a large pool of money set aside by the company that pays out to creators based on a variety of factors of that creator's content. It's not purely based on views, although definitely having more views will probably help. The idea of the Creator Fund is to directly support the creators on TikTok that are most valuable to its platform. It also has some eligibility requirements, like the partner program on YouTube, but in theory, the Creator Fund allows for a more stable and direct relationship between creators and the platform, something that YouTube has been slow to really develop. This is not a system without problems. The Creator Fund is only available to a select few European countries, so if you're an international TikToker, you're out of luck. And invariably, a small slice of people who contribute to the platform will benefit enormously from its monetization. The fund is limited in how much money it has, and as more TikTokers emerge, gradually fewer and fewer of them will start to take up more of that slice. That's namely because TikTok is, of course, very top-heavy as a platform, as pretty much all of these platforms are. Less than 1% of TikTokers have over a million followers. So invariably, problems of pay systems will lead to most of the money being paid out to bigger creators. You also have to remember that a view on TikTok is not quite the same thing as a view on YouTube, so a direct comparison is a little bit less helpful. But the point is, there could be some measure like this to help ease problems between YouTube's fickle revenue system and YouTubers who want to do it full-time. It wouldn't be cheap, but it's a policy that's doable for YouTube in the here and now. Some kind of creator fund could be used to incentivize content creators to produce, and it could also apply to content creators who are not necessarily as profitable in terms of ad reads, or because maybe their content is a little bit more contentious. It can provide incentives outside of purely just views. A big part of any discussion about YouTube is how powerless YouTubers actually are in relation to the platform. Sure, it's possible that individual YouTubers, especially the bigger ones like MrBeast, can get access to the company and support when they have issues. But what about smaller YouTubers, or even moderately sized ones? YouTube's constant need for growth has meant that where once a million subs might have been seen as a titan of the digital landscape, now a million subs is really just kind of the sign that you've made it as a professional. As YouTube continues to benefit from the labor of millions of its creators who have made the content for the platform, the question remains: how can those people get any justice from YouTube? The answer, I believe, is a union. The German DIY / slingshot YouTuber Jörg Sprav has a fantastic channel. If you love watching an enthusiastic man build wonderful contraptions, I highly recommend it. It's one of the more interesting channels that you'll see, and he's genuinely amazing in terms of his ability to build stuff with elastic bands. But by far, Jörg's most interesting idea is the creation of a YouTuber union. The idea makes a lot of sense. YouTube is a massive platform that depends on the labor of millions of its creators. If you aren't making content, people aren't coming to the platform, and therefore YouTube can't make any money from advertising. It stands to reason, then, that if YouTube isn't actually going to treat its creators better, then maybe its creators will have to force it to. Scarlett Gurm was right that YouTube is a faceless, emotionless entity, but it does listen to certain things. Its shareholders, mostly. But all companies can listen to force when their workers are united. I've demonstrated that YouTube has structured itself so that YouTubers aren't its real employees, but I hope I've made the case that the labor of YouTubers is what makes YouTube a success. It can't happen without us, so even if we're not employees in the traditional sense, we have the practical value of being employees because we contribute labor. With that in mind, a labor union of YouTubers would be the best way to force the company to listen to its YouTubers, because it collects the labor power, i.e. the content creation, into a collective whose power is greater than the sum of its parts. It's my sincere belief that anyone that seriously wants YouTube to improve should support the creation of a YouTube union, and York Sprav has definitely paved the way with his union, VerTube. I've included links to videos about this that I highly recommend you watch. However, I want to temper expectations by talking about some of the issues that surround the creation of a YouTube union. Firstly, a union derives its power from the collective. A union of one person is entirely powerless. A union of one person is powerless. In order for a YouTube union to really work, it needs to include as many YouTubers as possible, if not almost all of them. Which is definitely a difficult ask, since the most successful, and thus the most valuable YouTubers, are also unlikely to want to challenge their own financial position by standing against the company that's hurting many others when it isn't necessarily hurting them as much. The other problem is that YouTube is international. It has an international audience and its YouTubers are spread across the globe. If there's just a single union, like in, say, Germany, its ability to demand concessions will be limited only to Germany. We need an international YouTuber response for an international YouTube problem. It's not acceptable to me that we only aim to get some concessions for some YouTubers. We need to actually aim for all of them. I think right now, the creation and formation of YouTube unions, plural, represents the best avenue in the short term for solving the problems with YouTube, or at the very least, getting them to care about YouTuber concerns. YouTube is a company. It only cares about its financial goals. Therefore, the only way to make them listen is to hurt them financially, and we cannot do it as individuals. We need collective bargaining to make it work. Boycotts are notoriously ineffective on platforms like YouTube, or even video games. Boycotts are impossible to police, they're impossible to organize, and they're impossible to sustain. If a YouTuber tries to boycott YouTube, they'd only be hurting their channel, and therefore themselves. Without the ability to organize into a union, you could not guarantee a large enough contingent of YouTubers actually banding together and behaving in a collective way. It wouldn't be easy, of course. In fact, organizing labor in the digital landscape is much harder than in the physical one. But I do think it is a very necessary step if we are to do more than just suffer impotently against YouTube and its policies. Some of the problems of YouTube seem to come from the fact that the structure is very broad. YouTube is a general video platform. While the company prefers certain types of videos, usually the very advertiser-friendly ones, in theory, most types of videos that don't break the law can find a home on the platform. The problem is the audience's time and thus their ability to watch videos is limited. Each YouTuber is thus in competition with every other YouTuber for views. Sometimes that competition makes sense when you have two YouTubers making similar types of content, like, say, the discussions of real-world fantasy weapons and their implications. But other times, channels that have nothing in common are still competing for limited amounts of views on the platform. YouTube's certainly not going to run out of viewers anytime soon, but it also doesn't distribute those views equally. YouTube has about 150 million channels. Of that, 25 million have between 10 and 100 subs. Research indicates that in 2016, the top 3% of YouTube channels retrieved 90% of the viewership. That means that Shad, myself, and millions of other people are competing over the remaining 10% of views. For creators like Shad, and definitely myself, we're already in niches within niches. Him much less than myself, of course. Our ability to succeed, quote unquote, depends on our ability to capture minute and fleeting interest in the vast ocean of digital content. So maybe we shouldn't try. The word balkanize is used to describe a process whereby a place or a group is split into many smaller, often mutually hostile subgroups. It's in reference to the tragic history of the Balkans in our own world, which has been rife with instability and localized conflict. I think an argument could be made that suggests that the idea of building one single concentrated platform like YouTube was a mistake. Instead, it would have been better to have built many smaller platforms, each around specific content, and deliver content to an audience based on a premise. For example, the streaming service Nebula is specifically catered to educational streaming videos and podcasts. Loads of creators that are famous on YouTube, like Wendover Productions and Tom Scott, also produce content for Nebula. Exclusive content, I might add. Maybe this would be a better alternative to all of us desperately trying to carve out a niche in the great ocean of YouTube. I'm not necessarily convinced, however. While I think services like Nebula are important, and they should never go away, I also think they exist in a separate category to something like YouTube. Maybe there's a subscription service you have to pay to access the content, and it's only got 140 creators. Not anyone can create content for Nebula either. It's generally only a platform for already successful YouTubers to create content that's more experimental and thus less financially rewarding on YouTube. A complement to YouTube, but not a replacement for it. We've already seen the effects of trying to balkanize one massive digital entertainment media platform, and it hasn't necessarily worked out for viewers. I'm talking, of course, about streaming services. Netflix grew to prominence as an alternative to traditional TV with its fixed schedules. With on-demand streaming, you could watch whatever you wanted from the catalog, whenever, for how long. It changed the way people consume media in a very serious way, and when Netflix was the only streaming game in town, it created a brief golden age of entertainment. With a single subscription, you could access a vast library of all the types of content on the planet, and basically melt your brain watching the entirety of Friends back to back. There was a catch. Netflix was the platform for the content, but it was not, in and of itself, the creator or owner of all of the content that it hosted. Before long, plenty of other media companies like HBO realized they could pull their content from Netflix, start their own streaming service, and offer shows that people wanted to watch on their platform. And like that, streaming was balkanized. Instead of a single convenient platform with everything, now we live in a world where you need several subscriptions to watch a huge smattering of shows across multiple networks and platforms, all of whom are hostile to each other. I would argue that balkanization of streaming has only resulted in a worse consumer experience. If you want to watch something, now you have to know which platform it's being hosted on, pay the subscription for maybe one or two shows that you want to watch, and then remember to cancel it again when you finish. It's not that I want a single company to own all media and 1984-style deliver us content. The problem is not that there's a single convenient, efficient platform for everything. The problem is that said platform is controlled by a corporation that absolutely wants to extract as much money from its audience as possible. There's also a genuine value to the large digital ecosystem that YouTube comes with. It's so large and so diverse that it can support multiple types of communities within it, and those communities can both interact with and spin off from each other. It's almost like a second internet, but instead of web pages, it's videos. There is value in something like that existing, but the question is, who should own it? A lot of conservatives make very strange arguments about YouTube when it comes to censorship. They argue about the differences between a publisher and a platform, and that YouTube is a publisher masquerading as a platform, quote Conservapedia. A publisher, you see, is held liable for the things it publishes. A platform is just not held liable. More simply, if you use your column in the New York Times to insult someone, well, then the Times is liable for it because they published your article. They had a choice to publish your article and they went with it. But if you post the same content as a YouTube video, YouTube is not liable for it. They're a platform that gives you an opportunity to express yourself. Conservatives argue that YouTube is a publisher because they censor conservatives. That's expressing some sort of editorial control in the media, which is just not an argument that I buy. Conservatives are just terrible at sticking to terms of service. Most of them can't help themselves when it comes to hiding their bigotry, and they get booted for it. But there is an interesting conversation that's being obscured by all the right-wing whinging. Namely, why is a private company responsible for something so widely necessary for public life in the 21st century? While it's certainly not the case that access to YouTube is routinely a matter of life and death for most people, for many, YouTube and social media in general is a normal part of our everyday lives. Digital media will only become more prevalent with time, so why then is something as potentially important as YouTube owned privately? At the heart of this question is the idea that certain public institutions and services shouldn't be owned by private individuals, because private ownership, such as profit-making, will always take precedence over public good. Many of the problems of YouTube stem from the fundamental nature of it as an entity. YouTube is a private company. Its principal existence is to generate profit, either directly or indirectly, but this puts it in a conflict with its other goal, namely, being a platform for hosting massive amounts of video content. It can't simultaneously provide the best possible video platform while also maximizing its profit generation. The addition of ads made YouTube worse. It went from one ad to two ads. It went from skippable ads to sometimes unskippable ads. YouTube used to be able to buffer videos while you let them pause. Now you can't do that. Many of the features are gated behind paywalls. And we also see that YouTube makes changes to its policies based on furthering its profit. Introduction of shorts to compete with things like TikTok, the changes to the algorithm that precipitate the rise and fall of different types of content. They're constantly fine-tuning their system because at the core of it, there are two forces in contradiction with one another. And the profit-seeking side is winning. It might be easy to suggest that YouTube be taken over by the government. On the face of it, nationalizing YouTube would definitely be one way to remove the profit-seeking behavior from the platform. If YouTube is funded by, say, for example, taxes, then it is no longer required to have ads, or it can... It might be easy to suggest that YouTube be taken over and run by the government. On the face of it, nationalizing YouTube would definitely be one way to remove all of the profit-seeking behavior from the platform. It would enable us to remove things like ads from the platform because it's being funded by taxes. And then, of course, we can just have YouTube focus on being the best platform that it can, while the government is theoretically more accountable than a private corporation. Of course, this is far from perfect. For starters, YouTube is an international company. Would YouTube have to be nationalized in every country in which it operates? How would that even be possible? What about the governments themselves? I absolutely believe that a private corporation can be tyrannical, but the same can be said for a nation state. While I don't think terms of service is a form of censorship, we definitely do have extant examples from China about what a social media looks like when the government controls it. Do I want that? No, absolutely not. So what then? I'm not sure. The problem seems to be coming up with some kind of international organization that maintains and manages YouTube in the same way that things like Wikipedia are managed, just only at a much larger scale, because video archives are more costly to manage than just web pages. I don't think this is a solution for any time soon. I do think the creation of a genuine internet public commons, an international one, would be a good idea. But we are definitely very far away from the day when a global video platform will be freely and fairly available to everyone just for the purposes of providing them with a video platform. I do think there's a step in between, though. And it starts with questioning who should own YouTube. I've stated numerous times here that many of the problems of YouTube are as a result of it being a private corporation. It's not accountable to its users, and it's definitely not accountable to the private, not contractors, who actually fill the platform with content. There are contradictions upon contradictions that stack inside of YouTube, from how it treats its content creators to how it gatekeeps a better service behind a paywall. Ultimately, though, YouTube's only really accountable to a small group of shareholders who own it. Even the people who work directly inside YouTube are ultimately only cogs in that machine designed to improve returns on investments. What if that wasn't the case? A worker co-op is a type of business where the line between business owner and worker is essentially removed. There are many different types of co-ops, but for our purposes, a co-op is defined as a business where every worker in that business is also a part owner of that business, and also, importantly, has some say in how that business is run, usually through a scheme where one person, one vote, is used to run that enterprise democratically. Essentially, you combine the shareholder and the worker into one, and you get a co-op employee. Unlike traditional businesses, a co-op resolves one of the main problems inherent to businesses, namely that bosses are always trying to extract as much work for as little pay as possible, and employees are trying to do as little for as much pay as possible. That's a core contradiction. And a co-op resolves this contradiction by making the boss and the worker essentially one and the same. By design, content creators are not employees of YouTube, but maybe they should be. Instead of a partner program or a creator fund, maybe YouTube should instead be made into a co-op. This is obviously not something that I think could happen tomorrow, but I think it would be genuinely one of the ways that some of the problems with YouTube could be addressed. Of course, there will still have to be separations between technical staff and content creators and managerial staff and so on and so forth. But if we are to solve some of the problems of YouTube as a company, I think we need to look beyond the ways that companies are run today. In fact, I think we need, in essence, to kill the king of private enterprise. I made it clear that YouTube is a problematic company with a great deal of power. I also hope I've made it clear that we can't expect technology or some other company to come along and save us when it comes to dealing with YouTube's problems. A platform like this is probably eventuality in the digital landscape that we have created. In order for it to improve, we have to make it better. All of us, users and creators. We all have a role to play in improving this digital ecosystem of ours for the better. It's not going to be easy, and it's definitely not going to happen overnight, but it's also not impossible. By now, I imagine it's clear why I chose to open this video with a clip of Voss from Far Cry. Adversity is not the first YouTuber to complain about his treatment on YouTube. He's absolutely not going to be the last. One thing that has become clear from watching all of these videos is that a lot of YouTubers keep suggesting essentially the same type of solutions. Always focused on the individual, or always focused on the company. Make an alternative to YouTube, they cry, without realizing that we'd be trading one master for another. The same things over and over and over again. And yet, we have yet to change anything about YouTube. In fact, things have probably gotten worse. Chad's video was the straw that finally broke the camel's back for me, and it inspired me to make this video where I hopefully have convinced you that we need to go beyond our current thinking if we are to actually make a difference. I don't have all the answers, far from it. I invite you to tell me all about it in the comments. Well, what I do hope is that this video has given you something to think about, but the way that we think about our relationship to YouTube, and the way we operate inside a digital landscape. It's beyond any of us as individuals to do something. It's something that we have to solve as a collective. Thanks to all the patrons whose names are flashing by, your generous contributions have allowed me to make this crazy video. I promise the next one will be definitely about video games, and also much shorter. Good night, everyone. Our links and socials are in the description.